It is Friday, July 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the remains of United States military personnel from the Korean War leaves North Korea for home.
This was part of the summit agreement between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
Tens of thousands of displaced people in southern Syria urgently need assistance. And Mission Impossible star Tom Cruise goes all out with stunts in the new film. It's all ahead. A U.S. military plane brought back 55 cases of remains North Korea says are of U.S. service members killed in the Korean War more than six decades ago. The transfer was part of the agreement made last month between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and President Donald Trump during their meeting in Singapore. The plane landed at Osan Air Base near Seoul Friday morning, where it was met by members of the U.S. military. Friday marks the 65th anniversary of the signing of the armistice that ended the 1950-53 war that split the Communist North and the Democratic South. Another ceremony was held on the South Korean side of the Panmunjom Truce Village to commemorate the occasion. Canadian Army Lieutenant General Wayne Eyre, the deputy commander of the United Nations Command, spoke.
UNC oversaw the repatriation of 55 sets of remains from North Korea. 3 hours ago, they arrived and were received with dignity at Osan Air Base and will now continue their onward journey, bringing some measure of closure and peace to the families and loved ones who have long awaited their return. This repatriation is one more step along the way of many negotiations and confidence-building measures enabled by United Nations Command, working to thaw the years of mistrust in favor of cooperation and dialogue.
Speaking at the White House Friday, President Trump said the remains will be welcomed back to the United States.
Mike Pence, our wonderful vice president, will be there to greet the families. And the remains. And I want to thank Chairman Kim for keeping his word. We have many others coming. But I want to thank Chairman Kim in front of the media for fulfilling a promise that he made to me, and I'm sure that he will continue to fulfill that promise as they search and search and search.
VOA Seoul correspondent Brian Padden spoke with me about the repatriation of the remains of the American service personnel.
This has been anticipated since the Singapore summit. This was part of the summit agreement between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, that this was part of the trust-building measures I think they agreed upon to at the end of the summit to help work towards the whole denuclearization agreement. There are, I think, over 7,000 remains of former soldiers that are still in the possession of North Koreans. And today they've returned about 55 Americans, or the remains of those Americans who fought during the Korean War. They were picked up very early this morning by a military aircraft and returned to Osan Air Base south of Seoul. There will be a ceremony next Wednesday to receive them and to commemorate the return. And there will also be some DNA testing later to make sure that the remains are actually the Americans who we're missing at the end of the Korean War.
Well, Brian, as you said, though, there still are potentially thousands more remains left of U.S. soldiers in North Korea. Is it known at this point whether there'll be further repatriation of those remains?
It's one of the frustrations in dealing with North Korea, whether it's about denuclearization or family reunions, or in this aspect, the return of these remains. There's not a lot of information shared. A few weeks ago, I think the U.S. sent people up to receive them, and they did not come a few weeks ago. So they're getting partial remains. I spoke to one analyst earlier in the week who said part of the problem is that the North Koreans themselves don't know where all of these remains are at the present time. So it's going to take a lot of work and effort for them to collect them from different sites around the country and inventory and confirm and bring them to the border to bring them back to the U.S. But it is also the case, we are being told by other analysts, that you know, this is part of the game that North Korea plays. They make promises, but they dole out small portions at a time in hopes of trying to gain some sort of advantage in future negotiations, maybe get some sort of compensation in the future.
Well, apparently in North Korea, or I believe at least to the Kim family, for Kim Jong-un, dates are very important. Today is the 65th anniversary of the signing of the armistice that ended the Korean War, although I think technically the war was, I mean, at least the actual fighting ended. Mm-hmm. I believe officially there never has been a final end to that war.
Right. This is the 65th anniversary of the armistice, and it is symbolic, and it is probably not a coincidence they're giving back the remains on this day. North Korea has been, since the Singapore summit, and as part of the Singapore summit, North Korea has been pushing for a peace declaration, an official end of hostilities that would lead to a peace treaty. A peace treaty, of course, would require the U.S. Congress to certify and confirm it, but a peace declaration from the U.S. and South Korea that there will be no more hostile acts between North and South Korea and the U.S. and North Korea. And so perhaps the date of giving back these remains is kind of a reminder and a push in a way to try to get the U.S. to be willing to make that type of declaration. The North Koreans feel that they have made a number of concessions and since the beginning of the year, that they've suspended all nuclear missile tests. They have closed a missile launch site recently, a nuclear test site. So they have done a number of concessions and measures, even though critics have said none of the steps that the North Koreans have taken have reduced their nuclear arsenal in any way. But they've taken a number of goodwill measures and gestures, and they want the U.S. to reciprocate by signing on to a peace declaration. The U.S. has said that they are willing to consider a peace declaration after the denuclearization process is over. So North Korea and the U.S. remain far apart on this issue, as well as they remain apart on any agreement towards denuclearization, on how to implement that anyway.
VOA Seoul correspondent Brian Patton. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Greece's prime minister assumes political responsibility for the wildfires. California's governor declares a state of emergency amid fires in that state. President Trump touts a strong second quarter of U.S. economic growth. And Imran Khan wins Pakistan's election, but he will have to form a coalition government. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A group of Italian scientists have announced that they detected a 20-kilometer-wide lake of liquid water located about 1.5 kilometers beneath the ice of the southern polar ice cap of Mars. The scientists analyzed more than 3 years of data they gathered with a Mars Advanced Radar for Subsurface and Ionosphere Sounding Instrument on the European Space Agency's Mars Express spacecraft. After studying the radar profile of a region of Mars called Planum Australiae, the researchers found it to be comparable to the liquid water lakes that have been found beneath the ice sheets of the Antarctic and Greenland. They say this suggests there must be a subglacial lake at the location they scanned on Mars. While it's thought the temperature of the Mars subglacial lake is probably below the freezing point, they think a number of factors allow it to remain liquid. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, an Australian-based professor and conservationist suggests Australia may be a good place for some rhinos to be protected. We'll have a report. The The United Nations says nearly 200,000 people displaced by 5 weeks of fighting in southern Syria are in need of humanitarian assistance, but access to them is severely limited. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
An assault by Syrian government forces and the Russian allies has succeeded in dislodging rebels from most of the territory they controlled in southwest Syria. 5 weeks of airstrikes and barrel bombings have caused more than 182,000 people in the governorates of Dara, Kunetra, and Sweda to flee their homes. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says people are living in dire circumstances and urgently need life-saving assistance. While concern for their well-being is rising, the situation of some 55,000 civilians trapped in a stretch of land near the Golan area is becoming increasingly alarming. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says the 200 square kilometer area near the Jordanian border remains under the control of a group affiliated with Islamic State.
We are, of course, very concerned about this particular group's policy of restricting freedom of movement for civilians who are trying to leave the area, and only a very limited number of civilians have been able to escape. Those who remain behind are subject to heightened hostilities.
For example, Laerke says between July 21st and 23rd, airstrikes were reported in the area, killing at least 32 civilians, including women and children. He says agencies also worry about another group of some 100,000 civilians near the Golan Heights who continue to face hostilities and have no access to aid. He says the UN was forced to suspend cross-border humanitarian convoys from Jordan to the area more than 1 month ago because of the deteriorating situation in Syria. He says warehouses that once were stocked with food and other relief supplies now are nearly empty. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As all five species of rhino in Africa and Asia are endangered or face extinction, an Australian-based professor and conservationist suggests Australia may be a good place for some rhinos to be protected and rebuild their numbers within the confines of cattle stations or other enclosed areas. Bill Lawrence is a distinguished professor at the James Cook University in Cairns. He speaks with International Edition's Victor Beatty about efforts by European scientists who recently created hybrid embryos from sperm of the last deceased northern white rhino in a laboratory.
This is really getting down to sort of Jurassic Park type desperation, but the last male of the northern white rhino died in March, so there's two females left. So they're using frozen sperm and harvested eggs, and they've created essentially embryos in test tubes. And now what they're going to do is actually try to implant those in a southern white rhino female. So you're going to kind of have a little bit of a hybrid offspring, and that it'll be genetically a northern white rhino, but it'll be born to a southern white rhino mother. It's not an ideal situation, but this, as they say, desperate times call for desperate measures, and this is really getting down to extremely difficult situation.
Well, when we talk about rhinos in general, there are a number of subspecies, but the animal itself is endangered, isn't it?
Yeah, there's five species of rhinos, and they're all pretty much in bad shape. The one that's in the best shape of all is the southern white rhino, but it was knocked down to a century ago. There were only 20 individuals of it alive at all, and it's made an amazing comeback to about 20,000 today. For the other four species of rhinos, so two of those are in Africa and the other three are in Asia, they're all desperately endangered. For instance, the Javan rhino, there's only about 60 of those left, and they live in just a little tiny area out in western Java. The Sumatran rhino, all biologists will say, and we work in Sumatra, is that it persists in a few little pockets there, but we don't say where because we don't want poachers to get in there and wipe out those last individuals.
Poaching, how big a problem is it?
It's an enormous problem. It's a combination of things because the rhino's habitat is being, you know, destroyed and shredded and chopped up, especially by this huge expansion of roads that we're seeing happening all over the world. In particular, China is driving initiatives to expand roads all through the Asia-Pacific region and in Africa and Latin America and in Africa and in Asia. That, of course, is oftentimes putting roads right into some of the last wild places where rhinos survive. And that lets the poachers in, and then we've got poachers with automatic weapons coming in, and they're just gunning down the rhinos. And unfortunately, rhinos are, you know, they're big, they're kind of nearsighted, they're fairly predictable in their habits, so they're easy to shoot. Sadly, what the poachers do is just machine gun the rhinos, and then they chop off the horn and they leave the animal to rot. They don't use the skin, they don't use the meat or anything like that. It's just removing the horn, which can be worth thousands to even tens of thousands of dollars.
Now, you're part of a process of possibly letting rhinos run free in Australia. What's behind this?
The thing about Australia is we're seeing rhinos being wiped out of mostly developing nations with rapidly growing populations and relatively limited rule of law and lots of weapons. Well, Australia has large expanses of tropical and subtropical savannas and woodlands and rainforests, which is the kinds of environments where these rhinos live. And it turns out rhinos are not especially picky about what they eat. And pretty good rule of law, and Australia doesn't have firearms. It's much more limited and controlled here. So there really isn't, you can't really imagine that kind of poaching problem happening here.
Bill Lawrence of the James Cook University in Cairns, Australia. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Tom Cruise's latest action installment of Mission Impossible Fallout follows operative Ethan Hunt, the daredevil spy, on a mission impossible to save the world. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with Cruise, inhabiting his character Ethan Hunt, along with the rest of the cast, about the powerful visuals and the megastar's mind-bending stunts that keep audiences on the edge of their seats for almost 3 hours.
You had a terrible choice to make. Recover the plutonium or save your team. You chose your team and now the world is at risk.
With nuclear devastation looming, Ethan Hunt, an operative of the fictional independent espionage agency Mission Impossible Force, or IMF, reteams with field agents Benji and Luther, played by Simon Pegg and Ving Rhames, to go after three missing nuclear bombs. They are not alone. The CIA wants a piece of the action.
This is the CIA's mission. You use a scalpel. I prefer a hammer.
Enter CIA assassin August Walker, played by Henry Cavill, a wild card.
You don't understand what you're involved in.
Rebecca Ferguson also returns as operative Ilsa Faust, a match for Ethan Hunt.
We brought back incredible women and introduced women who all of them have a character and a reason and a purpose for being in this film, and that is gender equality.
Her feelings are echoed by Oscar nominee Angela Bassett, who plays Erica Sloan, the deputy director of the CIA.
I think what my character brings to the movie is gravitas, her brilliance, her mystique, her strength, her integrity.
From Europe to India, the almost three-hour action-packed film offers a tight storyline and a stellar cast. But the franchise's secret weapon is Tom Cruise himself, who performs his own daredevil stunts from a skydive 27,000 feet above ground, from a plane flying 167 miles per hour, to a vertical helicopter fall he himself is piloting.
He's going to crash. both of them are very intense. The helicopter, I spent a year and a half training, and I trained with aerobatic helicopter pilots, and I've trained in airplanes before. I fly aerobatics in airplanes, but airplanes are very different than helicopters. And then we went into skydiving sequence. Again, I worked with top professionals that trained me. It took over 106 jumps to get it. 106 jumps. And we thought, we planned to be there for a week, and we ended up being there almost a month trying to get that sequence. It was significantly more challenging than I had anticipated, but it was pretty exciting also.
I've done some of the stunts, nothing compared to what he does.
Co-star Rebecca Ferguson recounts her reaction when she saw Cruise doing the helicopter stunts above New Zealand's mountain peaks.
And someone, I can't remember, shouts or we look up, and it's so far away, but Tom basically drops from the helicopter. He's doing the helicopter stunt, and we haven't been prepared. And I scream, but I was terrified. Absolutely terrified until someone says, that's a cut, we've got that. And I thought, oh my God, this is a mission.
Whew. So how long will he keep it going?
Well, we wouldn't have the movies without them, but obviously there's a nail biter every time he does a stunt. So, but that's what we're here for.
Filmmaker Christopher McQuarrie does not take these stunts for granted.
Yes, I mean, when you look at what happened in this movie, he broke his ankle doing the simplest stunt in the film. There are no small stunts. So when you're doing a helicopter chase and you're jumping out of a plane at 25,000 feet, it's all pretty nerve-wracking.
Showtime.
Oh, my God.
But it's paid off. Critics are calling Mission Impossible Fallout one of his year's best action films. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Sounds exciting. Well, that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Speaking at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in California, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo had a message for the people of Iran who have suffered for almost 40 years under tyranny.
The United States hears you. The United States supports you. The United States is with you.
Secretary Pompeo said the fruit of the 1979 Islamic Revolution has been bitter for the Iranian people.
40 years of kleptocracy. 40 years of the people's wealth squandered on supporting terrorism. 40 years of ordinary Iranians thrown in jail for peaceful expression of their rights.
Regime leaders, he noted, line their own pockets while Iranians cry out for jobs and reform and for opportunity. He named some of those leaders. Head of Iran's judiciary, Sadegh Larijani, worth at least $300 million. Former IRGC officer and Minister of Interior, Sadegh Masuli, nicknamed the billionaire general. Grand Ayatollah Makarem Shirazi, known as the Sultan of Sugar. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, whose personal off-the-books hedge fund is worth $95 billion. On foreign policy, Secretary Pompeo said, the regime's mission of exporting the revolution has produced a decades-long campaign of ideologically motivated violence and destabilization abroad, while the Iranian people shout slogans like, "Leave Syria, think about us." At home, the regime's absolute adherence to the Islamic Revolution means it cannot endure any ideas that would contradict or undermine it, said Secretary Pompeo, which is why it so heartlessly represses its own people's fundamental freedoms. In response to the regime's abuses, Iranians are taking part in the most enduring and forceful protests since 1979, Mr. Pompeo declared. The proud people of Iran are not staying silent. The United States under President Trump will not stay silent either. The U.S., he promised, will take decisive steps to cut off the funds the regime uses to enrich itself and support death and destruction. He noted, however, the United States is willing to talk with the regime in Iran, but relief from American pressure will come only when we see tangible, demonstrated, and sustained shifts in Tehran's policies. Ultimately, said Secretary Pompeo, it is up to the Iranian people to determine the direction of their country. It is America's fervent hope that the next 40 years of Iran's history will not be marked by repression and fear, but with freedom and fulfillment for the Iranian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.